We are burning down the house here on the Heritage Radio Network. But you already knew that because of the genius of the internet. You found us. You are either listening live, yay, which I hope you're not, because it's a beautiful, beautiful, hot, muggy New York afternoon, 7th of August, 2011. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host, or you're listening through iTunes or through our RSS feed. This is the program where we talk about design, architecture, the creative arts. Today, I want to talk about a little bit of a diversion into the, or divergence, into the emerging trend where city planning, I have to get rid of my gum. Sorry, people. So bad of me. All right, that's better. In the old days, city planners studied city planning, and sometimes architects came down with these ridiculous notions of what cities, quote, should be like. But these days, urban design decisions, or shall we say, designs, projects, are increasingly being done by landscape architects, which we architects do not begrudge, because we love our landscape architects. Joining us here in studio this afternoon is Kathleen Bakewell, who is a landscape architect. Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for come a little bit closer. That's good.
Okay.
That's great. Kathleen is a graduate of the Harvard Graduate School of Design, our mutual alma mater. Thank you very much. And she is one of the, as I found out by reading her bio, what's the name of your little group that you've got? The Farm...
Brook Farm Group.
Brook Farm Group.
Right.
Well, Kate is one of the original experts in green roofs, I believe.
I was one of the early ones to do green roofs in New York City. First one being a green roof on the St. George Ferry Terminal, 16,000 square feet.
That's super. And, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was in 2000, in the early days before anyone knew what they were doing.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I said, sure, I'll try it.
Yeah, but it hasn't failed. It hasn't fallen
well,
through.
Well, it's changed over. I don't think it was exactly planted according to the original plans. The original plans were for it to be a sort of a sanctuary for monarch butterflies. And
nice.
Because it's that location is actually on the route of the migration of monarch butterflies as
really?
They go down to Mexico.
Who knew?
Right.
Right through Staten Island.
Right. So I like my work to have some more purpose than just being decorative. So when I found that out, that sort of gave a raison d'etre for the green roof, as well as it helped protect it from being value engineered or cut from the budget.
So do butterflies like things other than sedums? Because that's what we mostly see on green roofs lately.
Yes, they're actually not that crazy about sedums. They like this plant called butterfly weed, Asclepias tuberosa.
All right.
so that's an important food for them. And
is it a flowering plant?
Yes, it's a beautiful flowering plant with a bright orange flower.
Does it have a deep root structure?
Not terribly. It functions fine on a green roof. Well, with a few inches of growing medium.
Well, well, some green roofs, if they're intended for sedums,
right.
the root medium, or however you call that,
right.
is growing. Mostly rocks.
It's a pretty granular medium.
Rock.
Yeah, it's not even called soil. Right.
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 But so for this tuberosum.
Butterfly weed. We can skip the botanical.
You need actual humus and.
No, it does well in a dry soil like the soils
or the
media that
the
you
the
are
stuff
familiar
that will
with.
Work
right.
for sedums. So you
right.
could you can
right.
have flowering
right.
plants.
It's more a question of how deep you're planting the media. For sedums, they can function in a very, very, very thin depth, a couple inches. And then other plants like perennials, like the butterfly weed, need more depth. On the St. George Ferry Terminal, we were very fortunate to have 8 inches of soil depth or growing media depth.
So, right, and which is a lot of weight, which is something you can't put on your average Park Slope townhouse.
Correct. No, yeah. They redesigned the building in order to take that load. And
right.
That was just a unfortunate situation.
Because it's not just the dirt, it's also the water that's retained.
Right. But I understand the thing has been, I haven't been out there lately, and I understand it's not looking so great. So, time to redo, I would say, but I don't know where that's going.
So the butterfly weeds don't reseed?
They should spread and do fine. But when I looked at the early photographs of when it was initially planted, it did not resemble my planting plan. There's a problem right from the get-go there. I was no longer on the project at that point.
How about irrigation? Did that
irrigation
have an irrigation system?
Yes, for the first year or two to just allow for a plant establishment, and then it was cut off, I believe. But again, that we're going back now 10, 11 years, so it's time to revisit the project.
Yeah, well, gardens need tending.
Yes.
Now, I wanted to talk about, townscape. And townscape, to a great degree, I mean, if I think about the town that I grew up in, mm-hmm. outside of Chicago, mm-hmm. It was mostly post-war tract houses, but there was still an old sort of part of town. Mm-hmm. And I remember the wonderful, and I guess they were elm trees, because they were all gone last time I went back there. So I think of the town, or the old part of town, in terms of its cityscape, its landscape. Not the building so much as the combination of the canopy of trees in the summertime, and the fact that the tree roots had caused the sidewalks to hump up and down, and riding my bike, and it was great fun going to the older part of town. But now these days, in our days, we want to make everything perfect, and it seems that it's a pity that we can't plan in some humpy sidewalks happening where you plant a tree, because oh my gosh, someone might trip and fall or something like that.
Sure. Well, nature left to its own devices will give you some messiness.
Right.
So if you just maybe welcome it into more places, like drop seeds and fruit that stain the sidewalk and lift up the sidewalk.
Oh,
and
God,
there's a lot we will do.
I wish I had that Pete Seeger little thing.
What Pete Seeger? Oh,
God bless the grass that grows through the cracks.
Remember
that one?
I do not.
Roll the concrete over it, but it grows right back.
Right. Well, I collect photos of those types of things because I have a little collection called the Tenacity of Nature.
Oh, that's excellent.
And you see it do amazing things, like grow around trees, growing around iron fences, for instance. And
around them, the fence gets enveloped.
Absorbed by, yeah.
Yeah,
right,
but that's something that we can't. As designers, I don't think we can plan for that, which is too bad, unless we get into making, grafting things in peculiar ways.
Yeah, and if you do plan for that, you're often considered a little bit irresponsible.
Yes, because everything should be pristine.
Yes.
And,
permanent, not be changing. See, nature changes. It's dynamic, and that's not how municipalities want designs.
Well, in architecture, we like for nature to be absolutely constant, mm-hmm. because our buildings are in a certain place at a certain time in a certain climate. And if the climate changes, and we can talk about that later, there are different aspects of our emerging architectural thought, anticipating the worst.
Adapting, right.
Yeah. But before we get back to talking about townscapes, and Kate and I were part of Shoetown to Brewtown, which Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions here on Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday at, Jack, is it?
5.
Thank you. I thought it was maybe it's 5:30. At 5.
Nice plug.
Jimmy put that together, and Kate and I both were involved, and it was really fun, and you can find a video for that on Vimeo. Through beer sessions on heritageradionetwork.com. Anyway, before we get back to talking about towns, my little town, let's take a little musical break. Down the House on Heritage Radio Network with Kate Bakewell, landscape architect. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We're wandering around the topic of towns, because towns are where, as opposed to cities. Cities don't have a lot of landscape, or lately cities don't have a lot of landscape.
If you mean that landscape is green, but landscape is really all of the outdoors, right?
So we architects call that hardscape.
Hardscape, I don't use that term.
Interesting.
I just simply don't.
Okay.
It's a very inaccurate term, so. You mean pavement.
It might be planters, benches.
Uh-huh. Furnishings, site furnishings.
Yes.
Okay.
Site furniture.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We call that hardscape, as opposed to a building, a structure.
Or the bushes, which are the softscape.
We call that landscape.
Okay.
I suppose we should conform our
we went to the same school, didn't we?
Yeah, but separate.
Separate trays, yeah.
Yes, those of you who've never been to Quincy Street in Cambridge wouldn't understand trays. Gund Hall, where the Harvard Design School is housed, is a big sort of greenhouse kind of structure, except It wouldn't be a very good greenhouse because it faces east, northeast, I think. It's sort of like on the axis of...
It was built before people thought about that kind of orientation.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing that it doesn't face south with the students that get cooked. That would be down Quincy Street. But anyway, So it steps back, and every level is called a tray, which is as if the trays are interchangeable. Like, you could just, you know, take the architects out and plug in the landscape architect, take out the city planners, but, you know, they moved the city planners to the Kennedy School, I think.
They did?
Yeah, I think. It was just too bad, because occasionally we'd meet each other at the, like, the Halloween party, was the way, the only way that you would meet another graduate student in another school. I don't know what your experience was.
Well, I was lucky there was a development studio, which is actually the type of studio I was talking to you about for Shoe Town.
Yes.
Where the idea was to bring in people from the business school. Is it Stacy?
I don't know.
I don't know.
It's just one of Jack's.
Anyway, it was a design studio with real developers, with real projects, who worked with students that were collected from the design school, the Kennedy School, the business school, et cetera, to take on these problems in sort of a wide, comprehensive way. So, yes, I met people from other schools, and it was a pretty valuable experience.
We were very fortunate. I only met people like from the Ed School or the Law School because we had a better party.
Yes, that was a famous party that people would be drawn to.
Yes. So it was, in a way, the townscape of graduate students was one of, from my point of view, one of great...
Trayscape.
Or one of great alienation. There was nothing that drew people together. And in the, if you think about, the movie with Jimmy Stewart, the Christmas movie.
It's a Wonderful Life?
It's a Wonderful Life, yes.
Okay.
You know, that's sort of the prototypical American town, where there are houses with porches. And in my own experience, my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, retired to my grandmother's house in eastern Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a small town. The reason for the town having been founded in the first place still mystifies me. I don't know why there was this town there, but the houses had porches. And the old folks, who all somehow knew each other, either from the Rotary Club or from the country club, they would walk around at night or in the evening, you know, on a hot day like today. They'd wander by and they'd say, "Hello, how are you?" And perhaps they'd be invited in for some lemonade or some iced tea. And they'd sit on the porch.
You're bringing tears to my eyes with this sentimental image.
Well, it's very important to me.
So pre-air conditioning and probably pre a lot of car dependency.
Well, they didn't need to drive because you could walk.
Right.
I mean, these are people who grew up
without
they grew up without cars, and then as adults, they had ration cards for gasoline. Mm-hmm. So they had a mindset of, well, if I can walk, why should I get in the car to drive? Because Phil and Nellie, my grandma, they might not be home. You know, I just walk around. I just taking a walk, and hi, how are you? And if people want to talk, then they would sit on the porch. And in the case of my grandmother's house, her father had planted cypress trees a long time before, and they had grown up, and they were always green, and it was always a green corner, and it was always shady. And so I grew up as a little guy, just sitting, you know, reading my Mad magazine in the corner or whatever, while the adults talked about politics or the weather or the corn crop. And it was a way for me to be, use a big word, inculcated into their society.
Right.
So it skipped my parents straight up to my grandparents, and I had therefore a connection to a late 19th century world because the old folks sat on a porch. Now, in the case of my kids, if their grandparents were alive, but they're not, and if there had been a porch, and if I had raised them in a town where we had porches and people walked around, then they would have known about World War II. But we don't have that.
Well, we probably have a different version of that. I mean, I didn't grow up that way, and our conversations happened in a different way around the dining room table, not...
Well, that's good if you...
On the front porch.
But if you can... But so you were lucky that your parents invited other people to come to the dining room table?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, that... No, well, you say sure, but... But these days...
You have to be more deliberate with these actions. Yes, you're right. It's not just...
It's not a case.
You're strolling outside because it's a hot summer night.
Exactly.
You have to make the effort.
So,
except when you live in a city, which is even better.
I don't know that it's even better because, you know, I live in an apartment house. It's 19 stories tall. Okay, fact of the matter, I live on the first floor, but I don't have a terrace. I don't have an outdoors. And I'm not about to hang out in front of my apartment house talking to the people who live in that neighborhood because my community involves people who live 300 miles around. It's not the same as living in a town.
It's not the same. It's different, but there's different ways of having that same sense of community. I live on the Lower East Side and not exactly a bucolic place, but
no.
there are these collisions that happen. We have a community garden where people kind of end up bumping into each other.
That's a very good thing. You know, I was an academic came to our office on Friday.
Not to name names. You don't need to.
I've forgotten his name. I think he was working through his doctoral thesis, and he wanted to give us his lecture. And his lecture was all posited on the Rem Koolhaas book Delirious New York. And he was showing us slides of things that were in the book without any critical comment. And he got to... there is a point to where I'm going with this, and I don't want to forget it. He showed an example. You can cough on. I do it all the time.
I'm not going to do that in the microphone.
Kate is...
It's not pretty.
Kate is sitting in her pristine white dress, and because she had to hold a water glass, she has taken off her glove. Anyway... He was showing an example of a shantytown, a favela, and some boneheaded theorist had this notion, which was in the book, that they should put a gondola, a cable car, over the favela so that outsiders could come and observe, and because tourists would come in and spend some money, I guess giving some money to the people who ran the cable car, that they would bring money into the neighborhood. And I have to say that a couple of us were rather rude to this academic who was holding up this stupid bit of shit as a great... And he used the word intervention.
But was it really for people to observe the people living in the favela, or was it for... Because I had seen an example where it was a very practical thing to overcome the serious topography and transit problems, where the actual people who lived in those communities could use the tram or whatever to get back and forth to other places.
That's a great idea. If the people who lived in the favela needed to go someplace else and it was a long and arduous walk, if they had the money to get on the cable car, that's great. But this was presented as a way to bring in tourism dollars. And if you want people to come in and have contact with the people who are living in a less swell way than you are, how do you do that? Well, you might do that through gardens. You might do that through farmers markets where the people who are living in that place mm-hmm. have produce that they could sell, and they meet people from outside.
Right. Or just commerce and trade, which is the old-fashioned way, right?
You don't fly over it and say that it's a Disney sort of thing that brings money into it. And I've lost my thread.
We were talking about community gardens and social interactions that can happen out on the street in places in the city.
In the Midwestern world that I grew up in, which mm-hmm. may have been different from your world of Boxford, Massachusetts. But I think that the American experience might have been similar. Our forum, or Jack, coming up soon, our place of interaction when we were young was the drive-in or the Shake Shack. Let's have the next break. Jack, please.
Kids growing up in the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star. Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Sucking on chili dog, outside taste freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between the knees. Jackie say, hey Diane, let's run off behind the shady trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, let me do what I please. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone to walk on. Jackie sits back, flexes thoughts for the moment, scratches his head and does his best James Dean. Well, then there Diane gotta run off to city. Diane says, baby, you ain't missing nothing. Jack say, oh yeah, life goes on.
Burning down the house, I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Kate Bakewell. We're talking about town things. The demise of the porch. And Kate says, well, you know, you don't have to have a porch. You can talk to people in your neighborhood because
first of all, we're increasingly becoming more urban as...
Well, that's true.
As a...
The
humans.
The world.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So we have to understand... I think we have to maybe not get too attached to these... bygone eras. And, as lovely as they sound, I don't know, I didn't grow up with a porch, but really understand how we can have these same kinds of opportunities in dense cities. And so that's the challenge for the 21st century for planners and designers.
Well, yeah, like how do you make that happen? Right.
Well, I mean, most people, I think, agree that density is really, really important, so that you have... the economies that come along with that.
Sure.
You use up less footprint with, you know...
There's more... Therefore, if there are more dense structures, there's more space available for the word that you don't use, hardscape, and landscape, which you don't use. It's just all softscape.
Or how about more space available for civic life?
Or for being outdoors.
all those things.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know anybody who's against that. But just because you build it doesn't mean that they come.
Although if you look at cities in America that are well-designed in every sense of the word, not just physically, excuse me, they are they seem to be doing quite well.
Oh, yes. That was the point that I wanted that I wanted to make in the previous little break, was that the notion of experts, outsiders, who imagine that they need to intervene in a situation because they know better. I am very skeptical of that. I find the whole word, and this is, I don't know about in your world of landscape architecture,
right?
But in architecture, when anybody says that we're going to do an architectural intervention, I find the word of intervention so arrogant. As if the people don't know, as if these pointy-headed theoreticians are as if doctors, and they have to intervene and cure a disease, so highly arrogant as to be morally indefensible.
Well, I'd rather
just say we're going to do a design project and see how it turns out. Not that we're going to intervene. That's like sending the Marines into Nicaragua to save the locals for the banana company.
It's a loaded word. It's a word you pick up in graduate school.
And it's a word that should be banished, in my opinion.
No, you should put it on that list. There used to be a list that went around of all these words that
shouldn't be used?
Yeah, or that were pretentious. And
it's arrogant.
Yeah, arrogant. There you go.
And here was a professor talking about architectural interventions. It's like, I just have to jump in here. And it's like, oh my God, Curtis is raising his voice.
Well, speaking of which, have you been to the BMW lab on Houston?
Not yet.
That's an intervention.
That's in your neighborhood.
It's an intervention.
It's an experiment.
Well.
Okay. Is it working?
It's a nice structure. I stopped by a couple of times and it seemed to be, there were some lectures going on. Nothing that seemed out of the ordinary relative to, say, what you would see.
Isn't that next to the vacant space where urban archaeology had their, you know, capitals and architectural relics, then, like Houston?
Well, it's at Houston and 2nd Avenue, or Christie, where 2nd Avenue turns into Christie, catty corner from the Whole Foods.
Okay.
And, it's worth a look. It's a nice structure. I just don't know about the programming. I have to take a closer look because it's supposed to be about rethinking the city. And what I have seen so far is lectures and presentations to a sitting audience, and that doesn't seem to have quite the interactive, dynamic quality of rethinking the city
That's a canned lecture.
Right, But it was packed the night I went. Then another night, it was closing down. It was a rainy night, so it was kind of empty. So we'll see. It's open through some point in October, and then it's going to Berlin and Mumbai, I believe.
It's the BMW Guggenheim Lab.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So just architecturally, it's
kind of a cool
structure.
I haven't been there,
but
I know about it.
Yeah. Well, swing on by.
Hey,
yeah.
That's
an intervention, though. We're just talking, and I would say it's not an objectionable one. So just a little bit of defense of interventions.
I think it's a pop-up. That's a word that's been, you know, going around.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, you know, our hosts here, Roberta's Restaurant, they have a pop-up in Coney Island.
They have a pop-up at the BMW Guggenheim Lab.
Right, right.
Yeah. Give them a plug for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I know, I like pop-up better than intervention.
Okay, well,
I mean, just go with that. No, look, I bear the guilt of an American of a certain age where we intervened in a whole lot of other people's business, and look where it got us. It's not a lovely thing. Townscape.
Back to that. By golly.
By golly. Townscape. Yeah. Well, it's a word that used to go around. I guess people aren't using it anymore.
Townscape or by golly? Which is it?
Townscape.
Okay, got it.
I think people say by golly somewhere. I don't know where. I don't think they say it in Brooklyn much, but that's
no,
okay.
No.
Townscape. To me, it's it presupposes a kind of medium density, high, low, trees, streets, people, kids on bicycles, playing fields. And I don't know that there's a recipe for a good townscape, but some townscapes have it and some towns don't have a townscape.
Well, there are many efforts towards those recipes, aren't there? The form-based code and
what's that?
The new urbanist
these are all things
walkable.
I don't know about.
Oh, yeah, and then also the LEED standards for neighborhood development. So there's a lot of people who have tried to put some real some tools and direction and understanding on how you actually design places like this.
Uh-huh.
It has to do with, look at Celebration in Florida or Seaside.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
those are some of the early examples of that kind of thinking.
Early attempt to make a town.
Town, right, based on those ideals that you've been referring to.
Yeah.
Right.
But they didn't. Last I saw pictures of Celebration, there weren't a lot of trees. It was still just sort of...
Well, they take time, don't they, to get to be canopies over streets. That's the problem.
Yeah,
they're
I suppose.
Kind of slow.
Or
trees.
Maybe they planted the wrong kind of trees, or maybe you can't transplant a brand new, a sort of Disneyfied version of a New England town to Florida, and the New England town wants Norway maples or elms or sycamores, and it's Florida, and all you can grow are royal palms, which don't really have a canopy. They go up and at the top.
Not sure, but I did actually get involved in designing a mature site in the Hamptons, actually, with mature trees. And so
in the
village of Southampton, and we brought in 200 mature London Plane trees, each one with a 12-foot wide root ball, brought one by one.
Wow, that's big.
Yeah. So, and that was right because we want an instant old place,
and that's expensive.
Extremely. Yeah. It was a client who wanted to have something instant, and the problem is with that is that nature and landscapes need time to sort of find their way, and so there was quite a bit of mortality with those trees, even though they got the Cartier treatment in terms of everything, the top dollar spent on the tree movers, the nursery, every last thing, the maintenance. And yet, there were several, like 30 or 40 trees that didn't make it, which is shocking.
Out of how many?
Over 200, yeah.
And what was the project?
It was a 50-acre site in the village of Southampton for rich people.
Uh-huh. And they wanted an instant growth.
The idea was to create this place where it felt like 100 years ago. There's a famous street called Wyandanche Avenue Street, and it had those arching London planes that kind of fill in and create this cathedral-like effect. And it's gorgeous. So we were trying to create that in a season or two, which it doesn't quite work the same way, no matter how much money you spend.
That is appalling. 40 or 50 out of 200,
It was really, really tragic.
That's very sad.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking to see that happen. But had we planted those trees much smaller, little things, they would have over time found their way and established and become very robust and the way it happened in that other
avenue. Yeah, but it would
have
taken 30 or 40 years.
Exactly. So you have this dilemma, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I've long wished to have a mature orchard that's been tended. But whenever I had money to start planting trees, I realized that my grandchildren maybe might really enjoy the orchard.
Right, but even if the tree isn't that large, you could still enjoy the fruit. Is it the orchard and the effect and the grandeur of a beautiful orchard that you were after, or the fruit?
It's the time. I'd like to plant something and then be able to enjoy it.
Right.
But, even if I live to be 120, if I start now, you know, good luck that I can, one, hold on to the land, two, spend the time to tend the orchard, and three, the orchard's actually going to grow.
But don't you think you could get a lot of satisfaction out of just a few fruit trees, fruit and nut trees, and maybe a couple of grapevines? And
sure.
It doesn't take much.
Sure.
You don't need a big, giant, mature orchard.
It's true.
Give it a shot.
Yeah, well, sometime I'll find some land.
Or a rooftop.
Rooftop. Mm-hmm. Well, a rooftop would be nice, but a root ball for a peach tree has got to be like 4 or 5 feet.
Right. What if you planted it on the parapet wall where it could take the load? I mean,
parapets maybe a foot.
I know,
and
but
half.
You could fashion something.
Well,
linear. Yeah, you know, that's
good,
what I'm planning on doing because I want to do.
You want to work on that. So
well,
you
yes.
plant the root ball over the exterior wall where there's a lot of strength.
Correct.
Not in the middle
right.
where you're going to put bending on the
right.
roof.
Or you would need to reinforce it.
Very
right.
clever.
So you can do that, and you can have your permanent tree. Fruit nut trees there, and then the lighter things can go where it can't take the load.
And the windfall goes down on the street and nails people walking by. But
yeah, you have to.
Well, you got to tend it.
You got to tend it. You might have to guide it in with some rope or something.
Or you might have to have some nets.
Nets, yeah.
Like OSHA safety nets to collect that windfall fruit.
Building department would be okay with that.
If you called it a construction project.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
Loopholes. Excellent.
Well, but they've just changed the New York City zoning to allow one-third of a roof to have greenhouses. Did you read about that?
Oh, I've been trying to follow that, and I know there's been some changes in the tax abatement for green roofs, too, and I'm attending a meeting this coming week about that.
Yeah. Well, what I read last week here in New York City is that now the zoning has been changed, that if it's just a greenhouse, you know, not somebody's extra bedroom,
right.
But a greenhouse
uh-huh.
on
uh-huh.
a roof, up to a third of roof area can be urban farm in a greenhouse.
In a greenhouse. And what about, does it have to have a setback from sight lines? I guess that would have to do what kind of a district it's in. So that's exciting. That's great.
But a third of a roof. You could grow lettuce. You could have a hydroponic lettuce. You could you could be growing wheat, grass.
You could have some
but you can have a permanent greenhouse over
right.
a third of your roof.
Right.
And the DOB is working out the rules for what sort of structure that needs to be, wind load, stuff like that.
That's going to make a huge change.
It'll be good. I mean, it'll be good for people who want to be part of the food supply.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be good for the insolation, the solar load on buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't exclude being able to have a thin planting bed for sedums or some other plant material that can diminish the solar load
right.
and also
right.
hold heat in,
right.
Which would be good. I mean, they are going in that trend in Chicago to a
mm-hmm.
great degree,
right?
Which is very exciting, except for the heavy-handed way in which the former Mayor Daley applied it, which is like, we're going to do it. So that's it. It just, all city buildings are going to have green roofs. That's it. Okay. Thank you. Next.
And they made some great strides, and they've done some remarkable, that's my
yes.
old hometown, Chicago.
Yes.
But I was there before all that was happening. But now the trick with greenhouses will be the energy costs and to find a way to take waste heat that's generated from compost,
yes.
other
somehow
ways
somehow reuse it in the building that it's
yes,
sitting on.
Yes, rather than crank up the the heat
right.
that's not renewable.
But if it's making heat and it's on the roof, some will radiate into the atmosphere and some
mm-hmm.
will radiate down into the structure below.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, that's certainly better than just having a cold roof that has ice sitting on it.
Yeah. No.
So, I mean, that's a very exciting thing that is happening here, owing to the efforts of people like the people who own Roberta's. You know,
mm-hmm.
Chris Perichini was one of the founders of the Brooklyn Grange, which, oddly enough, is in Long Island City.
It's a very confusing thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, they couldn't find a roof in Brooklyn that was strong enough to put you know, a couple feet of dirt on it that they could actually farm.
Right. That's difficult. Yeah.
Yes. And a lot of the produce, I believe, Jack, you could weigh in here. Doesn't a lot of the produce for Ribbiter's come from the Brooklyn Grange?
A good amount of it does, yeah.
Yeah.
And other restaurants as well.
Yes. Which is very exciting because, you know, so Heritage Radio Network is a piece of this thread of thought. And not we, although we support them,
mm-hmm.
but us all have changed the zoning codes in a way that's... Mm-hmm.
Those conversations are all archived.
And they're all here, aren't they?
They are.
They are. Let's just have another, I don't know, about 3 minutes of Iris DeMent talking about our town. And we'll come back.
And you know the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Well, go on now and kiss the goodbye, but hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye to our town, to our town. Can't you see the sun setting down on our town, on our town? Good night. Up the street beside the red neon light, that's where I met my baby on one hot summer night. He was the tender and the order to bear. It's been 40 years and I'm still sitting here. But you know the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing could ever last. Well, go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Walked down Main Street in the cold morning mist. Over there is where I bought my first car. It turned over once, but then it never went far. And I can see the sun setting fast, and just like they say, nothing could ever last. Go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, but your heart's bound. Bring them flowers about every day, but I just gotta cry when I think what they'd say. If they could see how the sun's setting fast, and just like they say, nothing good ever lasts. Well, go on now and kiss it goodbye, but hold on to your lover, cause your heart's bound to die. Go on now and say goodbye. Bugs fly, but I can't see too good. I've got tears in my eyes. I'm leaving tomorrow, but I don't want to go. I love you, my town. You'll always live in my soul. But I can see the sun setting fast, and just like they say, nothing good ever lasts.
Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Kate Bakewell, and her friend Stacey Smith is just dropped in by parachute from London. And we were hoping to talk about housing, supportive housing, and all kinds of other things with Stacey, but you're here too late, I'm afraid.
I know. I'm so sorry.
But welcome.
Thank you.
But welcome. Put on some phones so you can hear what we're... you can hear better.
Thank you.
That works better. I've totally lost my track.
Well, let's at least applaud that Stacey made it out here all the way from London.
I think it's...
I was in Central Park.
Yeah.
All the way from Central Park to Bushwick. Well, we were talking about, you know, towns, townscape, what's a town, how does town work with landscape, and, you know, what's really important. We don't have porches anymore, but there are other ways that people meet each other and find community. That is to say, they find a town. They find, you know, within the city there are little enclaves. Every block in New York is its own little town. And I suppose in England, it's the pub. But we don't have pub life quite so much here as you have there.
So what makes a community?
Yeah, what makes a community? I mean, it could... There are people who think of having interventions, like we're going to insert a marketplace into this part of town. I'd like to think of it as a pop-up. We had a conversation about the whole philological construct of intervention, like we, the outsiders, know better. I'm skeptical of that.
Yeah, so am I.
Yeah, I think that any change needs to be collaborative and involve as many possible voices. Some people know some things other than, you know, more. Some people have outside information. Some people have training. But there are also, local or indigenous knowledges that should be respected. And that is what makes something like, I mean... You walked through the mayhem here of Roberta's. It's a tiki bar afternoon. And those of you listening who hear the pounding through the walls, that's people having fun. And Roberta's is not an intervention. It's some guys who wanted to have a pizzeria who also had an interest in cooking really good food. And then one thing led to another. And now there is a radio station here, and there are greenhouses on top of our radio station, which were funded by Alice Waters of Chez Panisse fame. And the guys from Roberta's now also have farming in the lot beyond us. And so it's a pop-up phenomenon that is collaborative. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, we're all part of a town, although I think of it more of as a tribe. It's sort of the radio/Roberta's tribe. It's tribal. Once you're in the tribe, you do what the tribe does. And what the tribe does here for us on Heritage Radio Network is the tribe does radio, and we talk about things related to better food, good food, how do you want to live, how do you want to make the world a better place.
Okay. Well, I can tell you a little bit about what we do in London.
Please.
It comes a lot more from the voluntary sector.
Yes.
Well,
this is all voluntary.
Yeah.
This is totally NGO. Actually, this is almost illegal, most of what we're doing here, which is the beauty of it. I mean, people pay rent, but then because there's not a lot of governmental oversight here in a post-industrial landscape of empty commercial lofts, no one really cares, which is what has allowed this to happen to a certain extent. Go on.
Well, I work for a women's charity, and we do a lot of work with different local women's groups. So rather than going in and setting it up, we actually find women who live locally, talk to them about what they want to do. If they have existing groups, work with them and bring them together, run different events, training, and from that have been able to shape something that's coming from the people who live locally, often who are living in quite isolated groupings and communities, many of them from all over the world, who have settled in London in the last, you know, 10 years or less.
Wow.
And they're living, you know, I'm working in Woolwich, which is in southeast London. It's a fairly deprived area, has limited facilities, particularly for bringing together women who, you know, might not feel comfortable to go to the local pub, many of those which are now closing.
Why? How could pubs close in England?
It's the economy, honey. And you can't smoke in them anymore.
Well, that...
makes a big difference.
That's bad, yeah.
But, so we found that, you know, though we're an organization that employs some local women, quite a lot of the women do live locally, we've tried to work with other women's groups, other already grassroots or kind of organizations or just women who get together for a particular function to try and kind of make more of a cohesion, but very much on their terms so that we're not dictating, you know, kind of what that becomes.
That's good. That's good. You know, one of the things that I find for me in my own mental community is just encountering people here in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
Who I've not encountered, but there they are presenting themselves. And as a way of going out, I want to talk about this this little band of young fellows. Probably the oldest can't be possibly older than maybe 26, called House of Waters. And when Kate and I were at Jimmy Carbone's Shoe Town to Brew Town, on the way back at the Bedford Avenue L station, mm-hmm. which was near to where we were having the event, mm-hmm. at the Brooklyn Brewery, there were these guys playing their music. And it was bass, drum, and hammered dulcimer, which is something that you run into in New England, where hammered dulcimer music is part of contradance music. But here were these kids playing on the platform. So I would say the concept of town could also be defined by your local subway station.
But just getting back to what Stacey was saying.
I mean, that could
saying,
be a town center.
But you keep looking for these physical manifestations of what a townscape. Exactly.
Yes.
And Stacey did not mention a single physical thing.
No.
She was talking about community from a very different idea.
That was all just people talking to each other.
Yes. Yeah. That's in the end what you were talking about.
Does it ever become a physical reality, or is it an emotional network?
It has a bit of both, because we do have a base that we use, but I don't think the building that we're in is particularly important. The location is important because it has to be accessible and feel like a place people connect to, that it is local to them.
But what the place feels like is really all a piece of the emotional support that's being engendered.
It comes from what we're doing within the place rather than the place itself.
So it doesn't matter what it looks like, it matters how it works for you.
Exactly, yes.
And that's one of my favorite things, that what it looks like could just be smoke and mirrors to distract you from how it is that you are living,
mm-hmm.
and which has deep architectural, philosophical roots. I mean, there was this neo-Marxist Italian named Manfredo Tafuri, who wrote Architecture and Utopia. And his slim little book from the late 70s said that, you know, what a city looks like, it's bred in circuses. How it works for the people who live there, that's what's really important. And we don't have conversations about how it works for the people who are living. It's all about what formalist sort of bullshit's happening, you know. And he said that, he had a Marxist bit. So he said that when the conversation focuses on style, it's just a manifestation of capital wanting to distract people from the misery of their lives. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, I happen to be an architect, so if what we do as architects actually improves the quality of life, it really doesn't matter what it looks like. What matters is how people's lives are improved. Now, the next step is, if people's lives are improved by better or more interaction with being outdoors in your softscape, Kate.
And then your word, let's just point out, right?
Well, what do you prefer? Let's just be definitive here. Is it all just landscape?
I actually don't know if we even have to talk about physical space to talk about the ideals that you're looking to achieve, which is human communities that function. I think it's about function.
Without trees or...
Trees don't have to be part of the equation. They don't. We like trees. People like trees. Trees are great. I'm a fan of trees. But there are many communities that work beautifully without trees.
I wish we could go to a second hour in which we could dissect Thorsten Veblen's theory of the leisure class, in which he posited that in the future, and this was written in 1898, that communities would not be defined by place, but be defined by like-minded people who communicated through the telephone or the telegraph.
Well, I mean, those debates are going on right now with social media. I mean, that's a very hotly discussed topic right now, and whether or not that's a meaningful community is in question by some people.
But because Burning the House, Down the House, here at a Heritage Radio Network, is a radio program devoted to discussions about the built environment, we will have to pass this conversation over to the philosophical people here. I'm very pleased to meet you, Stacey.
Nice to meet
you. I'm so happy that you could join us. I hope that you will come back, Kate.
Okay, if I'm invited, I might consider it.
Consider yourself invited.
Why, thank you.
Let's go out with some of that music from House of Waters, Boys from Brooklyn, including the pioneering hammer dulcimer player Max ZT. Shout out to you guys. You're fabulous.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. There's a lot of posturing and talking around raw milk these days and how great it is. But if you really want to get a full-on investigation into the pros and cons, the risks and benefits of raw milk consumption, here's a nifty website, www.realrawmilkfacts.com. It has a laundry list of FAQs, along with information from studies and reports from American and European science communities. If you flirt with raw milk consumption, this is definitely worth taking a look at. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.